From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for April 9th, 2024. Checking the calendar, the NBA playoffs are underway, and your Milwaukee Bucks host the Indiana Pacers this Sunday. Your Milwaukee Brewers are in St. Louis for the weekend, then they're back home at AmFam with the Yankees next weekend. And tonight is Gallery Night in Bayview, and if you need a laugh this weekend, there's Comedy Sports. Okay, here we go. Scientists say that at least 20 orcas, that's right, killer whales, off the coast of Spain are targeting and ramming small sailboats and fishing boats just for fun. Scientists agree the young orcas are just playing and not acting aggressively. That's not very comforting if you're in a boat or water skiing. The world champion Kansas City Chiefs had a fan who dressed in a wolf costume for all their home games. He was known as Chiefaholic. He's also known as a bank robber. Chiefaholic has pleaded guilty to a string of bank robberies. I wonder if they can get an orange jumpsuit that'll fit over that wolf outfit. And finally, we have a cicada update. Trillions of the little buggers are going to wake up this spring after a 17-year nap. They're being called zombie cicadas. These zombies are infected by a sexually transmitted fungus that makes them hypersexual. Well, after 17 years, wouldn't you be? On the podcast today, we have Joel Dreesing, Mike Helsel, Adam Bailey, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks for Max. Thanks for that, Max. Need a good laugh after what was a rough week overall for the markets. The Nasdaq down 5.5% this week, 893 points, closing at 15,282. The S&P 500 down 3%, down 156 points. Somehow, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished just slightly positive for the week, almost where it began, up 3 points on the week after a 211-point gain on Friday. Closing at the bell, 37,986 for the year. The NASDAQ now up just 2% after that rough week. The S&P 500 still up a pretty stellar 4.6, and the Dow up 1.3. You know, Adam, maybe just returns a good place to start this week. In particular, when you look at how high the NASDAQ had run, how strong returns were last year, we like to see a broadening of returns, meaning the S&P outperforming the NASDAQ. Normally the reason you want to get there is not because one fell apart and the other's done okay. It's because, well, stocks more broadly have come together. So what are you seeing? What are you looking at? What are you talking to clients about in a week in which we saw some risk off overall?
Well, I guess it's been about time since we had a pullback. You look back since October, the market has been on a sprint, and you sprint this far, this fast, this long. You have to pause. You have to catch your breath. It's true for sprinting. It's true for markets. And the pullback that we've seen the past couple weeks, it's normal. It's natural. It's healthy. To some extent, it's to be expected. For stocks just to consolidate, you have to before we can kind of rally on to the next leg of the expansion. We've seen the NASDAQ pull back, and a lot of that has been just some maybe stretched valuations. You haven't seen that so much in the Dow, especially this week, where valuations are just not as strained. The Dow even managed to squeak out a positive 3-point gain this week in the dividend payers. Some of that maybe is attributable just to the way the Dow exists. It's 30 stocks. They're price-weighted, so higher-priced stocks tend to command bigger lion's share of the performance. And this week, and especially today, United Healthcare, Goldman Sachs, Home Depot, McDonald's, American Express all had pretty good day today in their higher priced stocks, and they helped lift the Dow today.
Well, Mike, I think, you know, the key right now is we're in the middle of earnings season. There's a lot of news to come, especially next week on some of those tech stocks and the NASDAQ. But, you know, an area I know you know a lot about spending money, we're getting consumer data left and right, not just from some of the surveys that are out there, but now from the actual payment processors, right? American Express and Citi and Visa. And going to tell us a lot, I think, about the state of the economy and just how well supported maybe the returns we've seen so far are.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to consumer spending, actually, you know, payrolls have been pretty strong this year. decent consumption's been strong off the back of that, obviously, because if people have money, they're going to spend it. No one spends their money like the people in the good old U.S. of A. But we're also getting to that time of year, quite honestly, especially up here in kind of the northern part of the country, where people spend more money doing, let's just, things like event-based spending, right? And if you're getting a combination of payrolls being strong because wages, I believe I said this last week, wages have never been higher in this country, even though you can make an argument they should be a little bit higher, but that's another day. And you're getting to a point where, you know, concerts, ball games, times for trips, that's all coming up. I think you're going to continue to see that spending kind of drive the economy going forward a little bit.
Well, and I think we have a bit of a backdrop for spending that we haven't seen in other environments in which you might be concerned about a market sell-off, a recession, and specifically looking at the number of retirees whose ability to spend is no longer tied to their employment, right? If what you're going to spend tomorrow is based on your portfolio is worth more because generally markets have gone up recently. If what you're going to spend is based on what Social Security payments coming in, well, you got a nice cost of living adjustment from Social Security. Pensions for those that are out there have been mostly solid. And so if what we're really talking about is a market in which spending is more and more driven by those at or near retirement, well, there's less concern now that even a temporary shift in the labor market, which really we haven't seen, but if we did, there's less concern that has the significant downside that it once had when the largest generation of workers was in their high earning years. Now they're all at the tail end of their careers or retiring.
You're absolutely correct about that. But on the other end of the spectrum that I wanted to touch on is kind of the younger people. And it's something you kind of mentioned in your pre-show notes. Made me think of it when you talked about the housing numbers, which we'll get into. Some of my younger clients I've talked to, with where kind of mortgages are now and kind of where kind of they are now, they've stopped with the money they're making. They've kind of stopped saving for a house and have put that on hold and have started to use that money to just live. I mean, you know, McConaughey said it, L-I-V-I-N, just living. They're just out there. They've said, okay, the housing market, we're going to put that on hold for a year, two, three, maybe even five. We're going to take that money and I'm happy in my condo, I'm happy in my apartment, I'm going to go on the trips with my girlfriend, my wife, my boyfriend, my partner, whatever. And they're pumping that money into the economy instead of saving it for, like, their future house.
There's a lot of truth to that. It's the seasonality of spending. And at this point, if you're not going to buy a house and you've accumulated a lot of cash, okay, well, what are you going to do with it? If it's not going to go to a house, it's not going to go towards savings. You spend it on experiences, trips and travel. We've seen that in the hospitality sector. There's been some pretty good earnings there. Hotel bookings are up, flights are up, I mean, that sort of stuff. And then you circle that back into earnings expectations. Since we're in earnings season of this year, you take a look at the seasonality of it, and there's a lot of earnings growth expected in the second half of this year. To your point, maybe it's something to do with travel and hospitality spending, but you look at the fourth quarter of this year, third and fourth quarter, it really is the bulk of the earnings growth is expected to come later on this year.
Well, and what I think is so interesting is all this conversation about spending and pent-up demand and pent-up cash and, well, we're not spending on this, so now we're going to spend on this. It's no wonder the Fed's had a hard time getting inflation under control. Not only are they chasing the COVID money that was out there, chasing a federal policy, a stimulus policy that was easy for the better part of the last 10 years, they're also now chasing all this changing demand, right? It was this, now it's that. And so there's always going to be an area to point to and say, yeah, inflation's running a little hotter here than we thought. It had been housing for a while. And Joel, we got some data on housing this week, the 30-year mortgage back over 7%. It does seem that is weighing a bit more than we hoped it would on demand for housing.
It is, Kyle. Except that there's still demand out there, demand enough that the shortage of housing comes into play, and that's why the prices for houses keep going up. We heard from the National Association of Realtors that the median home price in March went up for the ninth month in a row on a year-over-year basis. It's the median price is now almost $400,000. But yeah, you're right. We the the other housing statistics, even from the National Association of Realtors, shows that home sales themselves are down. They're down from the month. They're down from a year ago. And we had housing start numbers and building permit numbers. Those are all showing the softness in the housing market. Although, you know, I still like looking at the longer term and the bigger numbers. And we're still, we've got housing under construction near record pace over, you know, data that go back to 1970. So that's impressive. And the other thing about that, though, and this maybe gets back to a little what Mike was talking about, younger people not saving for houses as much, is that a larger proportion of the housing under construction is multifamily. So there are fewer completions and fewer houses started and fewer houses under construction compared to the whole that are single family.
Well, and then beyond housing, we got information on retail sales this week. And, you know, good, not great, maybe is more of what we've seen in many areas. And retail sales, I think, paint a similar picture. Some mixed news there.
That's right. Yeah, the adjusted for inflation, retail sales were up for the second month in a row after four straight declines. So, you know, and that's showing that the economy is going to keep growing, and there's resilience there among consumers. And again, to the point of, you know, you're not saving up as much for those big ticket items, but the U.S. spent $94 billion in March in bars and restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this week it's a bit of a mixed bag in some of the economic numbers. We had good news from retail sales and industrial production, less news about everything surrounding housing. But we also got some decent news on capacity utilization as it relates to inflation, because inflation is something that's on the Fed mind and on everybody's mind. And capacity utilization, about 78, a little lower than what was expected, a little lower than the month from before. And where I'm going with all of this is that once you get capacity utilization north of 80, 82%, you start to get inflation that creeps into the supply chain. And 78 is meaningfully below that threshold where inflation starts to creep in. So just a reminder that, you know, at least as it relates to the supply chain, we're not having inflation creep in there.
And it's sort of a Goldilocks number where it still suggests that the industrial sector is performing on a pretty good basis. Yeah.
You know, Adam, I think some recent headlines on some of the gold and silver coins available at some of the big box retailers. I know that certainly that's something you're aware of. I know you've spent some time in lines at Costco, maybe not in line waiting to buy those gold bars, but I'm guessing you've seen folks looking.
In efforts of full disclosure, I am a Costco fanboy and customer. Me and my family shop there regularly. I was actually in line at Costco last week, Saturday, doing like the regular grocery buying for the Bailey household. And my oldest son, Landon, he points out to the sign at the checkout, says, "Look, Dad, you can buy gold here." And I was like, "Huh, how about that?" And he said, "Well, we should get some." And I looked at him, a little smile, and I said, "Well, why do you want to buy it?" And he says, "Well, because it's shiny." And well, there you go.
He wants a lot of gold coins. He wants a Scrooge McDuck it. He wants to dive in and swim around. That's what he wants.
Well,
to
you
do.
Know, never separate a boy in his dream. But we did not buy any gold bars. But if there's ever been, at least in my opinion, a sign of irrational exuberance around an asset class, being able to buy gold bars at Costco while you can get a $1.50 hot dog, your tires rotated, and 5 pounds of cherries. You know, that might be it. I think it's a sign that perhaps there is too much exuberance around gold. You know, just as a reminder, gold is finally now back and slightly above where it was in 2011. It's also above where it was trading in inflation-adjusted 2000 ounce back in 1980. So if for the people out there saying gold is a really good inflation hedge, I don't know about that, because it's now finally back to where it was in 2011, finally back to where it was inflation adjusted in 1980. And here we are. Now you can buy some gold bars in your line at Costco.
Well, and I think the challenge here, Adam, is twofold. One, it's we should care about price, right? We should care what we pay for something. We should care about what the historical market looks like for gold. And historically, gold has done nothing better than keep pace with inflation, while many other assets have far outpaced inflation. And the one that always comes to mind for me is just buying stocks. There's no better way to outpace inflation than to own the profitability of corporate America.
You know, this is a great example. While I was in line at Costco, I had an option to buy a bar of gold. But you know what? I would much rather own shares at Costco, right? They're on the other side of that transaction. They're who I'm paying money to each and every week and month buying gas or groceries. But that's a reminder, if you want to beat inflation, own businesses, not gold.
Well, and we should be clear, Costco's not giving that gold bar away, right? They're probably making maybe not a ton.
They're selling it at a profit.
But they are selling at a profit. And so when you look at what you have to pay to buy that bar of gold versus what you can turn around and sell it for, which is actually where, you know, kind of the genesis of this conversation came from. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about some individuals that bought those gold bars as a way to rack up credit card points. Hey, I'm going to swipe my card, get this gold bar, which should be as good as cash, get credit card points, and turn around and sell the gold bar for what I paid for it, because I know gold's supposed to be worth what it's worth. And then they quickly found out, well, yeah, that's what I had to pay for it, but nobody else is going to be willing to buy it from me for that. And I think that's a reminder that these kinds of things have transaction costs. And that if Costco or your local pawn shop is going to be profitable buying and selling gold, they're going to make you pay a lot more for it than they're willing to buy it from you for. And so I think the key here is to understand that gold isn't really an investment. It's a hedge. It might serve as some protection for certain scenarios. Inflationary hedges are certainly one of them, but is it the best hedge against inflation? Probably not. And is it a surefire way to make money? I'd argue probably not there as well.
And with the, like as Adam said, with the cost of gold right now and where it's at, I actually have had some clients that have asked me about it recently, and they're retirees. And I flat out tell them no, because I said, yes, you will always hear about when gold is at its high. You very rarely hear about when gold is at its low. And for retirees, gold is very volatile. So unless you're willing to like ride the bull, I do not recommend that whatsoever, unless you get a free hot dog at Costco. Then maybe we can talk about it.
Well, and I think that's the key, right, is you got to be able to afford the risk. And there's plenty of folks out there that, as part of their portfolio, they can stomach the risk. They want to stomach the risk. I understand why it makes sense for them. But at the same time, you have to understand what you're getting yourself into. And when I buy things, I usually want to get them at a discount. I'm buying that Costco stock. Long term is probably going to end up being a pretty good discount. I'm not so sure that that's the case given where gold is now. And so understand, if that's what you're buying, well, you're probably paying a pretty penny for that hedge that you're looking for. I think, Joel, the last thing maybe today, we got a question from a listener, and always appreciate when listeners write in. I think it's a good way for us to help understand what you're thinking about, a good way for us to kind of structure some of these conversations. And I'd love to be able to address the question. So what do you got for us, Joel?
Well, this is from one of our listeners named Tim. He says he listens every week. He appreciates the podcast. He also subscribes to our newsletter. So thank you for that, Tim. He talks about bond funds and how when he's taking his RMDs, his required minimum distributions, he doesn't even touch his bond funds because right now he'd be losing principal on them. And his question is, can bond funds really be considered safe money?
I think it's the perfect question for the environment that we've just come through. In that we operated for a decade, Tim, on ZIRP, on zero interest rate policy. And in an environment in which bonds pay nothing, or next to nothing, depending on what you were buying, there isn't any protection. You aren't afforded a rate of return even sufficient for the very little volatility that occurs in bond funds. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have owned it. What it does mean is that the return we saw from stocks, and the reason why, Tim, your RMDs came from stocks the last few years, was that much better than the return we saw from bonds, because bonds just didn't have that much to offer. but a reminder here that the environment we have now found ourselves in, and especially going forward, an environment in which the 10-year Treasury is no longer trading below 1.5%, but now trading above 4.5%, the overnight rate at 5.25% when it was 10 years ago at zero, the environment we found ourselves in is an environment that actually sets up very nicely for bonds again to participate in the safety of our portfolio. The end result of market volatility, and in particular stock market volatility, tends to be that bonds and stocks behave very differently. That was never going to be the case in which bonds had no room for price improvement because rates were as low as they were. And so I think the historical perspective looks very different long-term than it does over the last 10 years. And the view forward is going to look more like history than it did the last 10 years.
I think the question gets to the heart of, like, what should we expect for our bonds? What should we expect out of our safe money? By the way, not all bonds are created equal. Not all are meant for safety. If you go further down the credit spectrum towards the lower rated bonds, I would not call those safe. But for high quality, short, intermediate term bonds, what should we expect? Coming off of what was a 30-year bull market in bonds, where not only did you get your yield, but you also got some capital appreciation, I don't think that's going to be the scenario over the next 30 years. So what should you expect? Expect your coupon, expect your yield, which is a lot higher today than it was 7 years ago. You can get maybe 4 or 5% on a high-quality short-term bond fund, maybe a little higher if you go further out on the yield curve. But it's fair to expect your coupon, but I wouldn't say expect the price appreciation like we saw in years past.
Well, and I would say likewise, we've been able to sell stocks at pretty meaningful prices over the last few years. And so, you know, at the heart of the question is, well, if you told me that bonds were going to be the thing that funded my distributions, and instead we've been funding them from stocks, well, I think it really gets to the fact that while we have a plan, it isn't set in stone, right? That we're going to sell the thing that we can get the best deal on. Just like when I buy that bar of gold, I want to get a better price. Or when I buy that Costco hot dog, I want to get it at a discount. Not going to happen, but worth a try. But when I'm selling, I also want to sell the thing I can get the best price for selling. And that has been stocks. And there will be an environment at some point in time, again in the future, in which stocks look cheap. And selling stocks to fund a distribution isn't going to make sense anymore. And it's at that point in time in which you're going to be so happy that you have that coupon. By the way, that coupon is a lot higher than it used to be, Adam, as you point out. It's at that point in time you're going to be so happy that you have that coupon and that you can get what you want when you sell that bond, because we're going to have to sell those stocks at a discount. And so I think that's really the key is, if we assume that the last decade of returns in bonds is what the next decade looks like, then I think the question is spot on. Why are we doing this? What's the purpose of these bonds? But it's that very assumption, I think, that's flawed in that we're in a very different interest rate environment. And the only thing long term you really should expect from bonds is that interest rate. And so I think that's the key, Tim, is as you look at your portfolio, and in particular, what I hope is a very appropriate balance for you as an investor, where you take your money from is going to very much be a function of what can I get the best deal on when it's time to sell. With that, we enjoy doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.